Hello, it's Thursday, November the 20th. My name's John Dennis. Today, a bloodbath on the high street as retailers' share prices plummet.
Woolworths was looking like going bust in the run-up to Christmas. We've seen Dixon's shares fall by about a third to 10p, so that makes Dixon's, which has a turnover of £8 billion, worth approximately a week's worth of sales.
In other stories today, in the final days of his presidency, George Bush dismantles vital laws protecting America's environment.
Oil shells are, the dirtiest fuel on the planet, and it's very expensive to extract in addition. But they've now made available vast tracts of land for that.
And the number of house sparrows is in decline. The author of a new study explains why.
If we look at South and East Britain, we're talking about 6 out of 10 sparrows having disappeared over the last 10 or 15 years.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Before we hear about any of that, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news and a look at the papers.
Stock markets are sliding around the world again. In Europe, the British market closed down 4%. In the United States, the Dow Jones share index fell to its lowest level in 5 years after a drop in consumer prices and a gloomy economic forecast from the Federal Reserve. In Asia, markets have closed between 5 and 6% down. That's partly in response to the American news, but mainly because their exports are now falling. Companies in Japan like Sony and Nintendo have been hardest hit. In Britain, a speculation mounts of tax cuts next week from the Chancellor. Shops are slashing prices early in an attempt to boost the Christmas market. Leading the way is Marks & Spencer, which is offering a one-day promotion of 20% off. Other stores making extra efforts to draw in the shoppers are Debenhams and BHS. We'll have more on this shortly in the programme. Meanwhile, retail businesses are themselves up for sale. Woolworths is said to be available for as little as £1 for a chain of 800 stores. And shareholders in RBS, the Royal Bank of Scotland, will vote today on whether to accept a bailout worth £20 billion by the government. It would put more than half the company in the Chancellor's hands. Now, the civil war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN envoy there says he's expecting to get 3,000 more troops to help with peacekeeping when the Security Council makes its decision. The UN says the rebel militias pulled back and is allowing aid workers to reach refugees. Tougher penalties for speeding will be announced today by the Transport Minister. The penalty points for breaking the limit by a large margin will be doubled, so a motorist could be banned after only 2 offences. Ways of the police checking for drug misuse while driving will also be explored, such as testing suspected drivers' reaction times. That's the front page story in both The Telegraph and The Mail this morning, but it's John Sargent sweeping the board with the picture of him waving a fond farewell to Strictly Come Dancing in almost every paper. Strictly farewell, says The Independent. Sargent waltzes off, scoffs the Times. But the Mail asks, did he leap or was he pushed? The Sun finds a simple answer, saying Strictly gone cruising, pointing out he was already booked on a Caribbean cruise and hadn't expected to be still in the show for this long. The back pages are all football and the relief for England at beating Germany 2-1, even though more than 6 first team choices were injured. They all make much of how Captain John Terry scored the winner after his mistake with the keeper Scott Carson led to Germany's equaliser. The Mirror says Skipper is the late hero to make up for Howler, and the Mail calls it a fab finish. Terry snatches late winner to spare the blushes. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
For 99 years, Woolworths has been a byword for cheap and cheerful. But now, Woolworths is on the verge of becoming the ultimate pound shop. Its 800 high street stores are for sale for just £1. Our business editor, Deborah Hargreaves, says Woolworths is not the only famous name on the UK high street to be in serious trouble.
Well, there's a lot of bad news out there on the markets. The retailers' share prices have been doing very badly. Of course, the main news was that Woolworths is likely to be sold for £1. That's the 800 Woolworths stores. Woolworths was looking like going bust in the run-up to Christmas. We've seen Dixon's shares fall by about a third to 10p, so that makes Dixon's, which has a turnover of £8 billion, worth approximately a week's worth of sales. We got M&S falling almost below £2. Its lowest share price ever was £1.80. At the peak of the market, it was worth shares were £7. And today, M&S is having a one-off 20% off all items sale day, which is very unusual for Marks & Spencer. It very rarely does this. And it means that customers are quite disgruntled at that because, of course, anyone who's bought anything in Marks & Spencer over the past couple of weeks will want to take it back today, maybe rebuy it again at a much cheaper price. We've also seen Sports Direct shares fall to 32p, which is an all-time low. They, of course, were floated at £3 less than 2 years ago. So there's a lot of market turmoil out there. There's a lot of fears for the health of our retail sector.
Are we likely to see one of these retailers or maybe another retailer going bust before Christmas?
Well, that's what the market is worried about. And an MP has written to Alistair Darling today on raising concerns about credit insurance for retailers. This is insurance on retail debt. And most of them can't get it now. That insurance is being withdrawn. And this is what was one of the big factors in the Woolworths problems. And this means that it makes it very hard for them to continue in business. Austin Mitchell has raised these fears in his letter to Alistair Darling, saying he's worried that some of the big retailers might go bust. Their next rent day is due on December the 24th, Christmas Eve. And obviously, with cash flow problems, it's quite hard to meet big rent demands. And so there are fears around that day and the approach to Christmas.
Woolworths is for sale for £1, as you say, for its 800 high street stores. Is that a bargain or a poison chalice, Deborah?
Well, it depends how you look at it. You could say it's a bargain. That company obviously has great deal of problems. It has a lot of debt. It ousted its chief executive and the new one was brought in to try and turn it round. He said, you know, he raised more problems really than he was able to solve. There were fears that it could go bust. It still is the nation's largest toy seller and largest seller of sweets. So it still shifts a lot of stock. What's likely to happen is the restructuring group that is in talks to buy it will probably put it into administration and then pick off the best bits to take out and to run as a going concern. What's left for the shareholders are the two wholesale businesses, the online CD and DVD sales, and another entertainment business which has a license with the BBC.
And meanwhile, it looks like we might be getting another interest rate cut very soon. The Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee minutes were released yesterday.
That's right. Yesterday, we saw that the Bank of England had actually discussed a cut of more than 2% at its last meeting. It did, of course, cut by 1.5%, which was a big shock to the markets and to most people in the city who had seen that the Bank of England doesn't usually move in such big percentage ways. Its biggest cut before that had only been 0.5 percentage point. It shows that the Bank of England is very worried about the state of the economy. It's very worried about this severe slowdown, and it makes it an almost certainty that we'll get another interest rate cut in December's meeting.
Deborah Hargreaves, and the latest economic news is at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, an interview with Rachida Dati, France's first Justice Minister of North African Muslim origin, and soon she'll be the first single mother to hold ministerial office in France. She talks to Angelique Chrysaphis at guardian.co.uk/France. Patrick Barkham takes his green driving test and fails. Video of that at guardian.co.uk/environment. And Hitler has only got one ball. That was true, apparently. The truth behind the rest of the rhyme is at guardian.co.uk/G2. 2 months from today, George Bush leaves office. Between now and then, the president is working very hard to scrap important rules protecting America's wildlife and its national parks and its rivers from developers. Environmentalists say the changes in the law will put the public at risk. Suzanne Goldenberg is in Washington for The Guardian.
The Bush administration has actually been working quite steadily for months to put out a bunch of last-minute regulations, rule changes, in government departments, so to leave a lasting legacy and to impose its ideology on the next administration. And many of these changes are in the area of environment, where they are taking down pollution controls and protections for wildlife and for wilderness.
And how many of these rules could be completed before George Bush leaves office?
Well, the crucial thing here is timing. Most rules take effect 60 days after they're published. So if you count backwards, George Bush leaves office on January 20th. November 20th is the deadline. Any of the rules published before then will be effective and will be very difficult to undo.
Kind of thing. I mean, can you give us a few examples of some of the things that he's been trying to do?
Well, some of them are already done. For example, earlier this week, they opened up 2 million acres of land in the Rocky Mountain West in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming for oil shale extraction. Now, oil shales are, the dirtiest fuel on the planet, and it's very expensive to extract in addition. But they've now made available vast tracts of land for that. In another decision that's similar, there's been a move to open up land for drilling, oil drilling, quite near national monuments in Utah. In fact, this famous arch in Utah. There's been measures that would no longer compel the Pentagon and other government departments to do wildlife surveys to make sure that any kind of project or development they do does not hurt wildlife. There's been other measures that say to factory farms, gigantic pig cattle and chicken farms, that they no longer have to comply with water safety regulations for dumping their runoff, so long as they certify that they aren't dumping their waste products in streams. It's now easier for mining operators that operate just by lopping the tops off mountains. They can now similarly just certify that no, they aren't dumping debris and sediment into rivers and streams. So there's a broad range of regulations in the environmental arena that are going through right now.
And will the new president be able to reverse any of these rulings?
Well, that's the thing. These are very difficult to reverse. They're not presidential executive orders. They are rules that have gone through a very long and cumbersome process of being drafted by the various government departments and agencies and reviewed. So there's limited options for Obama. He can go through the same process again and try and get them undone. He can hope that there are legal challenges from environmental groups that would try and undo these regulations. Or there's a very little used act of Congress. In fact, it's been used only once by George Bush, in which essentially Congress could veto these regulations. But that's a very serious step. I mean, people are calling it the atom bomb of regulation, and it's unclear how whether that's something that can be used across the board.
Suzanne Goldenberg in Washington. I'm John Dennis, still to come in Guardian Daily. In our weekly celebrity spot, Mick Hucknall talks to The Guardian about music and politics.
I've noticed how it's weird that we never put in, we're never considered like an 80s band, or no one puts us in, no one puts us in the Spandau Ballet Duran Duran rack somehow, and then they don't even call us a 90s band even.
But first, the names and addresses of 13,500 members of the far-right British National Party have been published on the internet. They now face the possibility of disciplinary action at work or vilification. The leak happened because of a split in the party's leadership. The Guardian's Haroon Sadiq has the details.
The BNP think that it was a disgruntled former member who Nick Griffin, the BNP leader, described as a hardliner who was upset that, Nick Griffin seemed to imply that the BNP are too liberal for him, so he left. And his way of getting back at them was publishing this list on the internet, because I think a very limited number of people had access.
It is a genuine list, though, isn't it?
Yes, the BNP have confirmed it's a genuine list. It's not bang up to date. I think it's from last year, and they've said some people were people who'd sort of made inquiries to them, so were not necessarily members. But certainly, yes, it is the BNP have verified that it's a genuine list, and that's why they moved to get it taken down, although I believe it is still viewable on certain sites.
What effect will this have on the BNP?
Well, it's interesting because it's created a sort of media frenzy in trying to identify the professions that BNP members are in, and it's caused, the police have reacted quite strongly and said all BNP members are banned, while other sort of professions have said, well, it's up to individuals, provided they don't practice discrimination in the workplace. But Nick Griffin, interestingly, said he was quite happy to see the professions of people revealed because he thought that it gave a lie to the traditional stereotype of a BNP supporter as a skinhead oik, because it includes teachers, lawyers. And so he obviously sees some good in it, even though he says that it was completely wrong for names and addresses to be published.
And when they do establish who has been responsible for this leak, they've threatened legal action against them.
That's right. They got a High Court injunction in Manchester earlier this year preventing publication of the list. So they're claiming that the individual responsible could face jail. I mean, they used slightly words that on the face of them sounded slightly threatening, that they later clarified, Nick Griffin clarified and said all this was an expression that the person is going to face jail.
And not a threat of violence.
Exactly, exactly.
Is Nick Griffin right in that it doesn't, the picture that it paints of the BNP isn't the sort of cliched skinhead image?
I think to some extent, but the BNP have been working on cultivating that image for a while, and it's been recognised. I think some people like to use that image because it is so repellent, the image of the sort of green bomber jacket and the bother boots from the 80s and, you know, the violent thug. It's an unpleasant image, whereas Nick Griffin himself is, you know, he's a Cambridge law graduate, he's suited and booted, he's changed image. And Ian Cobain, one of my colleagues who went undercover and did an investigation, I mean, he discovered that a ballerina in the English National Ballet was a member of the BNP, which, you know, would not be most people's obvious stereotype.
It's ironic that the BNP is relying on European legislation in the form of the Human Rights Act in order to protect its members' identities.
Exactly.
Which it opposes this legislation.
That's right. They do oppose the legislation, and they seem not really to recognise the irony that they're relying on it. I think Nick Griffin said something like, yes, we do oppose it, but while we can use it, we will. So, they seem to be benefiting from EU legislation, is the truth of it.
Is there anger among BNP members that they've had their identities revealed in this way, that the BNP leadership hasn't looked after them?
I think there's certainly anger. I think when anyone's data is released, it causes anger. And even when it's not an organisation that attracts such ire as the BNP, you know, I think even if, I don't know, a list of another political party's members was published on the web, they might object, even though it was a more mainstream, more socially acceptable party. So it's not surprising that some BNP members are upset. And the ones who were the traditional BNP members, the green bomber jacket and bother boots, who I referred to, I'm guessing that they're the ones who don't really care. But it is the sort of new wave. I mean, if you're a lawyer, you're a teacher, I think I can see why they might be rather upset at the fact that this has leaked out.
Haroon Sadiq. The house sparrow is one of Britain's best known birds, but its population is in decline. It may be because sparrow chicks don't have enough to eat due to a shortage of insects. The first study into the 20-year decline of sparrow numbers is published today by the RSPB, De Montfort University and Natural England. Leading the research is Dr. Will Peach at the RSPB.
If we look at South and East Britain, we're talking about 6 out of 10 sparrows having disappeared over the last 10 or 15 years.
Now, you've been investigating the decline in sparrows. How was this research carried out?
We went to the lovely city of Leicester, and where we knew sparrows were declining, as they are in many suburban cities. And we went along there, and we were interested in studying their breeding success. There were some indications from previous work that sparrows may be struggling to raise enough young each year. So we went along there, we put up loads of nest boxes all over the city, and a proportion of those boxes were subsequently, you know, used by house sparrows. And so we were able then to study their reproductive biology in quite a lot of detail.
And what did you find out?
Basically, we found that far more chicks were starving than we expected. And what was happening was the adults were laying enough eggs and there were enough breeding attempts through the summer. But the problem was that once the eggs hatched and we had very small young chicks, we saw very high rates of starvation in the first few days after hatching.
And what could be the reasons for that?
Yeah, so it would appear that lack of insects is the problem. So sparrows generally eat seeds and cereal grains and so on when they're adults and outside of the nest. But when they're very small chicks, they need to be fed almost entirely small insects. So, you know, there's a source of protein and they can grow and develop rapidly. Now, if there aren't enough insects around of the right type, the parents will resort to feeding them scraps of bread and peanuts and so on that many, you know, householders will feed. But that really isn't enough to keep these young chicks going. They need insects. And we found that, you know, in most suburban areas, there just weren't enough insects to keep those young healthy and developing.
Why not?
Well, that is a slight mystery, but we can sort of put two and two together and see what's been happening in our suburban parts of our cities and also our inner cities themselves. And really, what house sparrows need, what the parents need, is certain types of vegetation, particularly native woody vegetation, things like hawthorn, brambles, honeysuckle, wild roses. Those sorts of species are covered in insects come the sparrow breeding season. And I think what's happened is quite large areas of this sort of vegetation has just been removed from our gardens and cities.
Well, my 9-year-old is a keen bird watcher and he'll want to know if there's anything we can do to help boost the sparrow population.
Right. So there probably is all sorts of things you can do. Really, the flavour of this study is to raise insects numbers in your back gardens. And the way you can do that is plant the sorts of deciduous woody plants I've just been speaking about. Honeysuckle is a great example of that. You know, it's easy to propagate, so it can be free, or you can spend a few quid and get a nice plant from your local garden centre, which will grow vigorously and quickly, and that will be covered in insects within a year or two. It provides berries later in the summer and it will provide cover for the sparrows all through the year, which they really need too.
Oh, they're back already. For more than 20 years, singer Mick Hucknall has fronted Simply Red. During the same period, he's gained a reputation as a womaniser and a champagne socialist. With The Guardian's Hannah Poole, Hucknall discussed all that and the end of Simply Red.
Because I made the decision, I think it's almost a year ago now, to stop working under the name Simply Red. And it seemed like an appropriate time. We'd done 10 albums and it would be 25 years in 2010. So starting out now gives us the time to get around the world, which we're probably going to do at least 1.5 to 2 times in various territories, and sort of celebrate with the kind of enormous support we've had from so many people from so many different cultures throughout the world, and just, you know, go out on a bit of a bang.
Is it a full stop? Is it the end?
It is for the Simply Red style, because it was sort of very unfortunate, but is usually the case where you get this kind of like, because of the nature of the internet and everything, you get one person in the media says one phrase, and within seconds the whole world is using the same phrase. The phrase that they used erroneously was splitting up, because I never used that word. It's a silly phrase to do when it applies to Simply Red, because I've been the effectively the band leader since the start of the band. I'm the principal songwriter, you know, and it's not really a band in a traditional sense. It's more like a kind of a jazz setup, you know. One of my idols, Miles Davis, when you look at his box set, he's got a list of musicians that he's worked with that are among some of the youngest and finest musicians of each generation that came through. That's something I really kind of envy and admire, you know. And I spent time putting this band together over a period of years, and we've reached a point now where I think the band I have is absolutely superb in the way it integrates together and plays together. And I've no intention of splitting that up. Mm-hmm. I've noticed how it's weird that we never considered like an 80s band or no one puts us in, you know, no one puts us in the Spandau Ballet Duran Duran rack somehow, and then they don't even call us a 90s band even, you know? So we're not like Blur and Oasis and that kind of thing. It's just like we're out on a limb in a way. And the other important factor is as well is in a political sense, because I've been very interested in politics ever since I was really quite young, like 9 to 10 years old, and I've wanted to sort of make kind of social comment within songs, but I've loved the idea of it being kind of like somehow pleasantly sort of masked in this rather, you know, I had this image once of like a bunch of Thatcherite Tories. Dancing to Money's Too Tight to Mention and not really kind of caring or getting it and just thinking it was really, you know, that's a nice, it's the sort of that little deception I find very appealing, you know, within music.
Mick Hucknall, and you can read Hannah Poole's interview with Mick Hucknall today at guardian.co.uk/music. Guardian Daily was produced today by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.